Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Congress recently cut public media funding, including for PBS and PBS Kids. New research from The Ohio State University highlights that educational media is beneficial to development and learning. Kids are certainly not watching a ton of educational content, but when they do, PBS's programs make up 45% of all the educational content that they view. And kids who used more educational content spent more time reading as well. Dr. Rebecca Dorm is the Director of Research and a Senior Scientist at the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at Ohio State University. She studies children's engagement with digital media and how educational content supports learning. And her peer-reviewed study with colleagues was published in the Journal of Applied Developmental Psychology. Welcome to All Sides, Rebecca.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
So the information about educational content and PBS programming came from a larger, longer study that you're doing. Can you tell me about the study?
Sure. So that's part of a much larger study with a broader goal of following children and understanding their educational progress throughout their academic careers. In this particular project, we were interested in looking at the media that children were using and looking at how much of it was educational. So we surveyed the parents and caregivers of 346 first graders and then asked them to list the TV shows, videos, apps, and games that their children were using the most at home. We then used a systematic coding process to look at how much children access educational content in their favorite media. And as you mentioned, we found that only 12% of that content could be described as educational. But that did vary very widely. So for some children, according to the adults we surveyed, educational media made up all of their top media sources. And for others, they listed no educational media at all.
So I guess we'll need to start with, how do you define educational programming? What is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So in this study, we looked at the intention behind the creator making that programming, right? So if the creator seemed to intend to make something that could teach either academic skills or also things like social emotional skills, we described it as educational. So it's not looking at necessarily the quality of the educational content, but just whether it's something that intended to be teaching any skills.
What made you decide specifically to look into educational programming versus, you know, everything that kids do on a device nowadays? Why look at the educational programming?
Sure. Well, we have decades of research showing that children can learn from high quality educational media. So I thought it was really important to understand how much children are actually using that content in their everyday lives. We know it's out there. As you mentioned, PBS creates a lot of really high quality educational content for children of all ages. But we didn't know a lot about how much children are actually accessing that independently and in their everyday lives at home.
Do you feel like there is a preconceived notion that children are, everything that they consume on a device is unbeneficial?
Absolutely. I think there's this larger societal viewpoint that, media is just mindless and it's the thing that kids do when they need to turn their brains off. And certainly it can and is used that way sometimes, but there is also a lot of potential educational value in the high quality content that kids are viewing some of the time and using as well.
So tell me a little bit more about the study. You said you surveyed caregivers, so you didn't actually talk to the kids, right? How did you do the survey?
Sure. So not for this portion of the paper that we're talking about today. For this one, we asked the parents and caregivers to report just what programming do children use most. So they just got a survey and we asked them to report 3 to 5 TV and videos programming that their child used the most at home, and then 3 to 5 apps or games that their child used the most at home.
Do you think the caregivers know? What if they're not sitting with their kid and watching what their kids actually watch? Is it just to the best of their knowledge?
Absolutely, yeah. To the best of their knowledge. These are first graders, so I think parents do have some insight into what their kiddos are doing at that age, but certainly it's not child report. It's definitely parent caregiver report.
What if I'm the caregiver and I don't want to admit how much YouTube my kid actually watches?
We got a lot of YouTube in this data. So if they underreported, then it's even higher than what we saw.
Yeah. So the research involved self-observation of the caregivers onto what media the children were consuming. Did you worry at all about any potential mistakes, or do you think that they accurately reported the names of shows and such?
Sure. So we don't expect this to be perfect one-to-one correlation with what kids are actually doing at home. And it doesn't tell us much about the time, how much time children spend engaging with each of these programs. But the idea here was to give us a sense of how much educational content overall children might be viewing and using without asking parents specifically about educational content. So you can imagine you were already asking about what we call social desirability, right? So are parents reporting what they think someone wants to hear or what makes them look good rather than what's accurate? And we actually think that by asking them just, oh, what's your kid into these days? What shows is your kid watching right now? What apps is your kid using right now? We are trying to get around some of those issues of social desirability rather than saying, how much educational content does your child use, right? Which you can imagine parents might want to report higher levels of educational content in a survey if they're asked that specifically. So by just asking about the content overall and then having this rigorous systematic coding on the back end, we're able to get around that a little bit.
So when you talk about this coding on the back end, is it just because... I don't know. I mean, all PBS Kids programs probably identify themselves as educational, but something like on YouTube, I can definitely see that, like, you know, an unboxing video probably is not educational. But what if they tag themselves as educational because they're teaching you how to play with the toy?
Right. So we did not rely on the creators' tags. We relied on me and a bunch of undergrads sitting around watching a bunch of YouTube content and asking, is this teaching some of the skills that we have listed? Is it teaching alphabet? Is it teaching counting or numbers or math? Is it teaching science content? Is it teaching social emotional skills? So we had a list of things that counted for what we considered educational. And then it was our team that was making that judgment call.
Okay. So do you consider teaching a kid how to play with a toy in an unboxing video? Is that educational?
That would not have been considered educational in the study, no.
All right, got it. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about children's educational media consumption with the director of research at the Crane Center at Ohio State University, Rebecca Dorr. So you said you didn't ask parents about the number of hours on the screens. I mean, that's a huge thing, you know, how much time there is on screens, because everyone thinks kids are rotting their brains on screens. Is that I'm sure somewhere else in the Crane Center you're looking at that, just not here.
Absolutely. And we did, sorry if I misspoke, we did ask about that in this project. What we didn't ask is how much educational media are your children using on, how much time are they spending using educational media? So we do have a measure of how much parents report children are using screen time overall. And what we actually found is that the more kids were using educational media, the less time they spent on screens overall.
Oh, yeah. Well, explain more about that. So if they're watching educational videos, those kids watched less?
Sure. So you might think that more educational media would mean sort of more overall screen time. And actually, you mentioned reading as well. Less, you might imagine it would mean less time spent reading. But what we actually found here was the opposite. So kids who used more educational content actually had lower overall screen time and spent more time reading. And I think that's really important because it shows that educational media, healthy screen use, and reading can sort of go hand in hand, right? And it's reassuring for parents and for anyone designing interventions around these things, because it suggests we can encourage more educational media without necessarily worrying that it's going to be increasing the overall amount of time children are spending on screens and crowding out more enriching activities like reading. Hmm.
So you mentioned healthy screen use. So that's interesting, because there's probably a whole argument out there that no screen use is healthy, just because if you're thinking of old school ways. But nowadays, there is healthy screen use?
In my view, yes. And I think the research supports that, especially when it's high quality educational content, especially when it's things that can be co-viewed or co-used with an adult who can connect it to the child's life, or even when it's not necessarily, you know, I sit down for half an hour and watch the show with my child. Maybe it's something I ask about at dinner afterwards, like, Oh, which Daniel Tiger episode did you watch today, right? Oh, it's the one where they get married. That's a good episode with the wedding. That's just like how we're going to our friend's wedding next month, right? And so it's something that you can connect with your child's life and sort of build into what you and your family are already doing to support your children's development and learning. That's what I consider healthy screen use.
Yeah. So did you notice a shift in the content whenever you interviewed? You said it was 346 families of first graders, right?
That's right.
Is there more, guys? I don't know how many years you've been studying this, but is there more YouTube now, I guess is what I'm asking. Is there more social media? When I think of a first grader, I just think of YouTube Kids, maybe.
Yes, I didn't code that systematically in this data, but especially definitely in the educational content we looked at, there was some YouTube, and we definitely spent a lot of time viewing YouTube videos when we were coding these data. So there's definitely a lot of YouTube. I don't have a direct comparison from earlier data, but yes, I think it is anecdotally and from other research definitely increasing in prevalence and how much kids are viewing data these days.
And did your study capture educational content only at home? Did you talk to them about if they have screens at school or at a babysitter's house or something like that?
We just asked in this part of the data about what their favorite programs, their most used programs. So we didn't necessarily ask about where it was used. So some parents for the apps and games, for example, reported on apps that we expect were likely at least introduced in school and maybe used in school, but also used at home. So we don't have a great sense from the educational media data about where they were using this content, but it's sort of overall what parents knew about their most used content.
Was it just watching something or like, because that makes me think of iReady at school, which is you have to play, play, I don't know if play is the right word, but you have to answer questions. So were you doing all kinds of content or was it just watching or was it
Yes. So
games too?
we asked separately about videos and television, and then separately about apps and games. And we have both of that data, both of those pieces of data here.
Okay. So what were you seeing when it comes to like watching a TV show versus games? Do kids play more games or watch more TV shows?
Overall, there is evidence that children are doing spending more time watching video than they are necessarily playing apps and games. And what we found here was that 12% number, the amount of educational content was relevant for both. That was overall. We found that apps and games tended to be slightly more educational on average, I think about 15% compared to children's television viewing, which might suggest that parents are sort of seeing apps and games in this more educational light. Like you're saying, it's interactive. They have to respond, they have to answer questions. And it might also be driven by some of those apps like iReady that you mentioned that could be introduced at school as well.
Okay, so digging a little bit more into these numbers. So, of all of the content that these kids are consuming, only 12% of it was educational, right? That's kind of lower. I mean, I would expect it to be low, but that's lower than expected. So, what are they watching? What are the other 80 some percent watching?
Sure, they're watching things that intend to be primarily entertainment, right? So they're watching shows across other programming. You mentioned, PBS would be all educational, but they're watching a lot of YouTube, as you mentioned. They're watching other programming that is intended primarily to entertain.
So besides YouTube, are we talking like Nickelodeon or the Cartoon Network, things like that?
Yes, absolutely. As well as some adult directed content, right? We saw some game shows and things like that on ABC, NBC, Netflix, things like that.
They're watching first graders are watching Wheel of Fortune or something.
That might have been in there. I can't promise.
Okay. But then of that 12% that is educational, you found that 45% of that was from PBS. Is that right?
Of the videos and television, yes.
So, I mean, that's a lot, right? Is that a good number? You do numbers all the time. Is that pretty high, statistically speaking?
That was striking to me. Yes, I expected that it was going to be prevalent. And that's why I looked into it, right? I looked into it in light of current events and the recent rescission of funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PBS. And I was really interested in how that would show up in this data. And I was surprised to see it was that high. And that 45% was by far the highest proportion for any source of children's educational programming. Nickelodeon and Nick Jr. is in second place at 14%, and YouTube came in third at 9%. So much lower compared to that really prevalent source from PBS.
So Nickelodeon and YouTube do have some educational shows, though, right?
Yes, they exist. They're out there.
Okay. I don't really watch much Nickelodeon, so I'm trying, because I was trying to think of one, but I don't know. Do you know the name of one? You can think about it while we take a break. So when we come back from the break, we'll talk more about this, the federal funding cuts to PBS and what the impact that could have on educational programming. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Rebecca Dorr of the Crane Center. Rebecca is going to stay with us. All Sides continues in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. PBS has lost funding, as well as all public media. But PBS has long been the leading outlet for educational content for children. New research from The Ohio State University highlights that educational media is beneficial to development and learning. Still with us is Rebecca Dorr, whose research we are talking about today. She is the director of research and a senior scientist at the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at Ohio State University. Thanks again for being here, Rebecca.
Thanks, Amy.
And listeners, we'd love for you to join the conversation. If you have a question about educational media, what are your children watching, and is it educational? Maybe we can answer that. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rebecca, I want to dive into some PBS programs that are educational, but that's what I'm most familiar with. That's why I kind of asked you. I was like, what on Nickelodeon is educational? Because I was just trying to get a grasp of that. Did you find the answer?
I pulled up some during the break. So Team Umizoomi is a math show that was in this data, reported from Nickelodeon. Bubble Guppies teaches more social emotional skills. Mm-hmm. And then Dino Dan is, I think, a relatively newer science show.
Okay.
On Nickelodeon.
And I was surprised because in a couple articles I read related to your research, you know, PBS Kids was cited, and then you would mention Nickelodeon and YouTube, but Disney wasn't mentioned. Did you look up to see, were Disney programs educational?
I was surprised by that too. There were some, but it was less prevalent than I thought it would be. I was surprised that YouTube was higher than Disney. I thought we might see Disney and Nickelodeon up there behind PBS.
Yeah, the big popular program now, in my understanding, is Bluey. Do you feel like Bluey is educational or no?
We did not code Bluey's educational in this data.
Okay.
So again, it had to be something that was very explicitly and intentionally teaching novel skills. Not necessarily that children can't benefit from some more narrative content that's primarily intended to entertain. I know Bluey is a very popular one, and a lot of shows can have good messages and morals and takeaways, but we know that especially very young children don't tend to understand those messages as well if they're not super explicit. So in this project, we had to have the content be explicitly teaching, especially for those more sort of abstract social emotional skills.
I have to say, I feel like Bluey is more educational for the parent, maybe, than the kid.
Absolutely. And I think that's true of a lot of, especially the social emotional shows, but across all of this programming, that it's getting parents comfortable with new ideas. So in the social emotional context, like, how do you talk to your kids about difficult topics, right? So Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, which is a sort of modern spinoff of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, does a lot of that. And I think they're, some emerging evidence that is definitely more helpful, or helpful for both parents and for children, right?
Well, and you mentioned a few Nickelodeon shows there a second ago. A really popular one is Paw Patrol. Is Paw Patrol educational?
Paw Patrol is sort of on that line, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you decide if something is intentionally teaching that social emotional content or not? We did code Paw Patrol as educational in this content because it is trying to think about, you know, how do these roles fit into our community and how do we help our community?
Lots of problem solving in Paw Patrol.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's get into the idea that PBS Kids programming right now. You basically, in light of what was happening at a federal level where federal funding cuts were hitting PBS, you took information that you already had and you kind of just like, I want to look and see how much of this is from PBS Kids. So can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Exactly. So thinking through what we were seeing in current events, I was really concerned about what was happening and thought it would be really interesting to look into how much of the educational content that children were watching did come from PBS. And as we talked about, it accounted for 45% of the educational content that children were seeing. And I think that really shows that public media is fulfilling its mission by offering this free, accessible, high quality content that truly engages children. But the future of PBS is really uncertain right now, given the this recent decision. And this raises concerns for me about the availability of these valuable resources, especially for children in under-resourced communities.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because there's a lot of platforms that you have to pay for to get the content. You know, we mentioned Nickelodeon and Disney. You have to pay for the app to be able to see these shows or have cable. But PBS remains one of the few accessible, trusted sources of free educational programming. So when you heard about the federal funding cuts, what did you think as a researcher regarding this idea that PBS is free?
Right. So I think it's really concerning because PBS isn't just another media option, right? It's a democratic value, sort of like investing in public schools. So it ensures that every children, regardless of their background, has access to that free, high quality educational content that's not behind those paywalls and the subscriptions. And in nationally representative survey data, Americans rate PBS as one of the most trusted institutions in this country. So when that funding is pulled, it's not just individual families who lose out, right? We risk larger societal costs down the line in terms of widening educational gaps and missed opportunities to support children's learning. Public media is one of the few tools we have that really reaches across income and geography, and cuts like this really undermine that mission.
In your research, the 346 first grade families that you talked to, did you look at socioeconomic data with them? Do you know, where they live and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. So interestingly, we didn't find differences by socioeconomic status in how much educational content parents were reporting. And I think this does suggest some degree of equitable access, likely at least in part thanks to free platforms like PBS. And this really highlights that importance of that public investment in educational media to ensure that all children, especially those from those under-resourced communities, can benefit from high-quality content without barriers like paywalls.
Did you ask the parents about paywalls? Like, because there's a lot of stuff you can watch old SpongeBob to your heart's mm-hmm. content on YouTube for free. You don't have to have Nickelodeon to be able to watch it. So I guess, do you know where they were accessing it from?
We didn't get that information in the study. That would be really interesting.
Okay. But the study that you're doing and where you pulled this, that of all the educational content, 45% of it is from PBS. It's a part of a larger study, right? Are these the kids you're following them and seeing how they consume media for several years? Is that right?
This is actually part of another project that was not primarily focused on media. It was primarily focused on actually children sort of preschool to elementary school transition. Mm-hmm. And so we just popped in a few media mm-hmm. questions in there to be able to look at some of this information. We have several other ongoing studies now that are primarily focused on media where we are following children over time. I can talk about those if you're interested.
Yeah. Tell me more about kids over time. Do they use more screen time as they get older and that kind of thing?
We don't. We have sort of newer studies mm-hmm. that are ongoing, so I don't have the data to report on that from our own studies, but certainly nationally representative data and data from other projects suggest that media does increase over time as children get older. Certainly much, much younger children, sort of the under two set, has lower levels of media, potentially because parents have heard that it's not recommended to provide as much media to infants and toddlers. And then it increases a little bit during that preschool age range and then gets higher as children get into the older elementary grades and beyond.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about children's media consumption with senior scientist at the Crane Center, Rebecca Dorr. Listeners, if you'd like to join us to ask a question about the media that your kids are consuming, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There are worries that screens are taking the place of reading. It seems like online media consumption is not taking over reading after all, from what you're seeing. So should we give children a little bit more grace about how much screen time they have?
In my view, I think so. And it's kids, but also parents, right? Mm-hmm. So there's evidence that parents are experiencing a lot of stress and guilt around, mm-hmm. around the media use that they're allowing their children to have, that quote unquote screen time, right? And there's evidence that parent screen time guilt is actually related to lower parent-child relationship satisfaction, which mm-hmm. concerns me as a parent, as a researcher, that if parents are so guilty and worried about their screen time, that's actually affecting their relationships and their interactions with their children, which we know has super important impacts on child development. So there is evidence that screen time is not necessarily all bad. Certainly, when, as we said, when you're using it, using high quality educational media or incorporating to your family's life, co-using it, talking about it afterwards, it's certainly not all bad.
So if you're getting into more fights about the screen time than you're having positive, then maybe you need to relax a little bit and say it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then also, screen time is used as a reward a lot. Do you, in your research, have you looked into at all whether the screen time as a reward is a good thing?
That's interesting. I don't think we have a lot of data and information on that. We're asking about it in some of our current projects, but I think it's a really interesting question. We use dessert as a reward a lot, right? Things that kids like and that we know is motivating to them does tend to be used as a reward or as a punishment for taking it away when they don't behave the way we want them to, right? But I don't think we have a lot of research on sort of how that impacts that parent-child relationship or children's interactions with screens.
And I wanted to get back to the idea of whenever you said that only 12% of the content being consumed was educational. Now, I'll continue to add that of that 12%, 45% of it was PBS, which is great. But if only 12% is educational, if the kids are going to be on the screens, would your advice to parents and caregivers be to try and like get that 12% number up? If you're going to be on the screen, you might as well make it educational.
Absolutely. Right. So I think it's not necessarily, we should be, encouraging more screen time because we want educational screen time. It's, we should take the screens that kids are already using and make it better screen time. Right. So, how can we, it's not about that guilt or pressure. It's about making the most of the media time that's already happening. Mm-hmm. So even introducing one new educational show or app into your child's rotation could really help. And importantly, parents don't have to be experts on what that content should be. We've talked about a few shows here and there today, but resources like Common Sense Media can really help them find high quality options. So Common Sense Media has a website and an app that has reviews and ratings by experts for the educational quality of the content that your children might be interested in viewing or playing.
We have John on the line from Columbus. John, what's your comment? John, are you there?
And
oh, okay. Hey, John, could you start over? I'm sorry, we lost you for a second.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. I'm John. I'm 52 years old, and I am speaking as someone that I feel has benefited from those educational programs when I was younger on PBS. There was a lot of science shows. There was a show called 3-2-1 Contact that like really sparked my interest in science. And reading and like going to the library. So I think those shows are pivotal. And I understand that it may not equate that way to today's generation, but speaking for myself and even my kids who are grown, PBS was like a huge part of their learning.
Thank you so much for that comment, John. As a researcher, what would you say about PBS's content as it relates to learning?
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. We know there is a lot of strong evidence that PBS content and educational content in general can support children's learning and development and is intended to, right? And has is research-based and curriculum-based and advised by experts to create those positive effects that John mentioned. There's a recent project that looked at sort of adolescents' retrospective reports on their consumption of Daniel Tiger content when they were younger, and they remembered a lot of the songs and the lessons, and they really it really does have a strong impact on folks' lives, as John mentioned, so many years later. I also wanted to pick up on what John said about the STEM content, or the science content that he mentioned. We did find that STEM topics were really prevalent in the educational content that we saw in this study. And, you know, the content John was viewing was before this, but more recently there has been this sort of push for an increased focus in these areas in the US in recent years in response to those poor international rankings we've probably all heard about in the US for our student STEM preparation. And that led to increased levels of federal funding dedicated to math and science programming over the last couple of decades. On PBS, which may have led to some of the science and math content that we saw here.
You said you watched some shows in order to figure out if they were educational or not. Do you have recommendations? What did you find were the best PBS kids shows that you would recommend? As you know, just as someone who works at the Crane Center and studies this all the time.
Sure, absolutely. So I mentioned Daniel Tiger, I think, a few times, and that's definitely one of my favorites. As I mentioned, it's a sort of modern spinoff on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but it has really high quality social emotional lessons teaching children and parents how to talk about difficult topics and handle difficult situations. I also really like Super Y is a great early literacy program that teaches alphabet and letter sounds. There's a lot of great content out there, both on PBS and on other programs.
Mm-hmm. I always say my kids are older now. They've aged out of PBS Kids. But I always say that Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood made me a better parent, actually. I learned more about parenting my children than maybe my kids got out of Daniel Tiger itself.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's really interesting because there's, you know, research on whether Daniel Tiger supports children's social emotional learning, but it's sort of hard to tease apart what the kids are getting out of it and what the parents are getting out of it. Because if the parents are then taking those little lessons and songs and using them with their children, how can you tell which is which? But to some extent, it doesn't matter, right? What we want is that parents are viewing that content with their children and they are pulling away those lessons and using them in their everyday lives. So that's great to hear.
I definitely dealt with tantrums and learned to leave the park better because of Daniel Tiger Neighborhood. I can tell you that much. We also, just to end on, we talked about how the study showed that 12% of the media consumption in your study was educational. I want that number to be higher. I mean, it's not going to be 100% educational media. Kids are going to watch shows that are not educational. But what can we do, or how can we get that number higher, or what number would you wish to see in the ideal world?
Sure. So I do think we can do more to get that high quality educational option into children's hands. I think we can educate parents, teachers, and librarians about how to choose and encourage high quality educational content. Platforms can also do more. You mentioned YouTube a lot today about how they can elevate that educational content through better discovery tools and algorithms. And then public investment, like funding for PBS, is really critical to keep those high quality options free and accessible for all families.
We're going to, we did get one more call. I want to end with Marie in Columbus. Marie, what did you want to say? It's about YouTube.
I just want to know if there's any research about it because it seems so addictive. We have a 10-year-old grandson with Down syndrome, and he just is mesmerized by it. And what I'm trying to look for is something that maybe would be equally mesmerizing, but would help him learn to read because he is learning, but it's so slow. And their attention is laser focused on YouTube.
Yeah. Have you done any research into why YouTube is so addictive and what else we can do instead?
Sure. I mean, that's just not specifically, but we do have some research on YouTube, and part of it is potentially that it's the algorithms, right? So like you watch one video and then it's figuring out which video you're going to like the most next. And it's so easy to click over and continue watching and going down a rabbit hole. And so that's where I'm talking about what the platforms can do, right? So the platforms think about how they can elevate high quality content and not just send kids down these rabbit holes of, as you mentioned earlier, Amy, unboxing videos, or I don't know, whatever your 10-year-old is into. Can it say, okay, well, if they're into this type of unboxing video, maybe they'd be interested in this type of educational content, and sort of push them in that direction. So that might be one way that YouTube as a platform could help support this goal.
And one last thing I wanted to end on, because I forgot to ask you about it earlier, but this just reminded me because Marie mentioned it was her grandson, the gender role. Girls are watching more educational content than boys. Is that right?
That's what we found here. Yes. Yeah. So we're not exactly sure why, but it's in line with some other evidence about preferences. And so overall, there's some data suggesting that boys might prefer more action-oriented sort of video game content that might be less prevalent in educational media, whereas girls tend to prefer, on average, that more sort of relationship-focused content, which might be more prevalent in the educational programming that's out there, which I think is really important for producers and creators of this content to think about. How can we create high quality educational content that's going to be attractive to children of all genders?
Well, I want to thank you so much for telling us about your research, and thank you for your time today. Dr. Rebecca Doerr is the Director of Research and a Senior Scientist at the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at Ohio State University. Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how PBS Kids programming is used in classrooms around Central Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Congress recently cut public media funding, including for PBS, just as new research from Ohio State University highlights the importance of children's educational media. The need for high-quality educational content still exists, and while Congress stands by its decision in halting PBS funding, PBS stands by its dedication in creating meaningful educational content. Jan Pollard is the Early Childhood and Outreach Coordinator at WOSU Public Media. Welcome to All Sides, Jan.
Thank you.
So although PBS is a national organization, there's local PBS stations, WOSU, us here, we're one of them. And in fact, WOSU has an education department. We call it WOSU Classroom. Can you tell me the main goals of your work in WOSU Classroom?
Sure. WOSU Classroom takes resources that PBS has, and we model how to use them with children, families, and educators across the state.
So part of what you do is you encourage others to use this PBS programming, as you just said. So you're teaching other people how to take what's on PBS and bring it into their classroom and their home, both?
Exactly.
So can you give me an example? Like what's a PBS program, and then how can you use it beyond just looking at the screen, I guess?
We do this all the time. So something that we do every month is Second Saturday Kids Days. And so it may look like a free fun event, but everything that we
Which
do
it is
very
it's a fun event. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. But everything that we do is intentional. So the different learning stations are done purposefully. So let's use Curious George as an example. If families are watching a Curious George episode, we'll say ramp. Curious George is building a ramp for a dog to get him out of the basement. So how can we make a ramp, and how can we use that as a learning experience? So something that we've done or will be doing on the south side in our learning neighborhood is families will come in. They'll watch that little tiny clip. We don't even use a whole episode of Curious George. And then how can we use that as a springboard for learning? So they will use recyclable materials. They will make a ramp, and then they'll test their ramp to see how fast a car can go down or a ball can roll down. You know, an area that's foil versus bubble wrap. So we anything we try to make fun and as a learning opportunity.
And so you're in that example you just gave, you're going to invite families to a place and you're going to teach them, right?
Right.
But then you also bring in preschool teachers, and right, and you teach them how to use this too.
We work with anybody that's working with young children. So whether or not it's a home child care provider, somebody that works in a center-based child care, stay-at-home mom, anybody that has access to young kids is our audience, yes.
You also have an example that I happen to know about because I helped put them together. Yeah. You had some math take-home kits. Can you tell me about those?
Sure. Right now we have a grant through PNC Grow Up Great, and we are developing 5 different learning kits. They're family math kits. Every child in Columbus City Schools pre-K will receive a kit. Every kit is different, so there are 5 different themes, and we provide a Zoom link so the families are able to log in, and we do it in real time with them. And it's just a simple activity that they can do to increase math skills. So, for example, starting in November, we will be disseminating those first round of kits. There's 2,300 of them on each one, so totaling 11,500. So we have a lot of work to do. But they'll receive a deck of cards, a simple deck of cards, something probably people have at home. And how can you use that to do math with young kids? Well, there's lots of things. There's counting, there's sorting, there's patterning. You can bring in shapes, you can bring in color recognition. So with a simple deck of cards, you know, what can you do with that? So using everyday learning opportunities to boost. Yeah.
Our last guest, who's a researcher, she spoke about the criteria for what is an educational, high quality children's show. What are some of the criteria that you know of for PBS Kids? Because she mentioned, you know, all PBS Kids programming is educational, but not everything on Disney or Nickelodeon is.
Sometimes families will ask when we're out and about doing events, like, how do I know if something's educational? The biggest thing that I look for, and when my son was little, you know, is this content making my job as a parent harder? Or is it making it easier? Well, one could argue, you know, setting your child down on an empty screen with nothing. You know, I think that if you can find something that your child is watching and do something with it to make it educational, I think it's good to go.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how PBS Kids programming is used in classrooms and in homes all around Central Ohio and across the country as well, with Jan Pollard, the Early Childhood and Outreach Coordinator for WOSU Public Media and WOSU Classroom. So our last guest, Rebecca Dorr, conducted research on how much educational content children are consuming. And in a follow-up study, she found that nearly half, when they're consuming educational content, which isn't a ton, but when they are, more like almost half of it is from PBS. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't, because we have, I was a PBS kid, so I'm biased, and then I work here also. So it doesn't surprise me. PBS has wonderful content. It's just where it's at.
Yeah. And I mean, how do you feel about PBS losing funding? You know, all of us here at WOSU are impacted by this, but the idea of PBS Kids not being able to continue to create some of these programs, I mean, that's sad.
It's heart-wrenching. It's awful because, you know, we get excited when there's new content. We're able to do so much more with the content that we have, and it's heart-wrenching. I know I believe Weather Hunters was delayed. It was supposed to come out, I think, a little bit earlier, a few months prior, but Weather Hunters is made it through, and we'll be seeing it today, actually.
Yeah. Actually, I do have a clip of that. So despite the funding cuts to public media, PBS was still dedicated to launching some new content that they had in the works, and in fact, a brand new program called Weather Hunters. So let's hear a little bit of the theme song.
Kids, it's Weather Hunters.
Our family loves to look for weather. There's so much we want to know. Weather Hunters.
That's us. Weather Hunters. Let's go.
Round the world, around the corner. Our adventure's just begun. Could be cloudy, could be sunny.
The kids, the forecast calls for fun.
Whatever the weather.
So any listener who's listening carefully there may have noticed they heard famous NBC weatherman Al Roker's voice in that clip. So not only is PBS making new programming, but they have famous people in it. What are your thoughts on the ability of PBS to still get this new show out with Al Roker?
It pleases me that it wasn't stopped. I think it's designed for kids age 5 to 8, mm-hmm. I believe. Lots of famous people in it. And this is something that, you know, weather is all around us. So, you know, what do we wear in the morning kind of thing? Why are the clouds looking like that? I know when my son was young, we talked about the weather all the time. So it's something that is common and we can learn a lot from it. So I'm very excited about it. And I think that encouraging this type of like environmental stewardship as a mm-hmm. young child is a great idea. So I'm excited to learn. I've only ever seen one episode, so I'll be tuning in to see more, but I think it's going to be good.
As someone who helps develop ways for parents to incorporate like watching the show and then doing an activity for their kids, are you excited to maybe, you know, work on some weather activities in the future?
We are. It's been a little while. During the pandemic, we did an online virtual meetup with families. They're called Family and Community Learning Series. And one evening we did talk about the weather, mm-hmm. And they did paper dolls and they had to dress their doll according to what the weather was like. They had a little die that they rolled. And if it was rainy, are you putting your snow boots on? Or are you putting your raincoat on? And so it definitely spurred conversations with our families through that. So.
Well, and I think for Weather Hunters, it's super cute. I encourage people to check it out. And the dog's name is Cumulus, which is super. I love that.
Yes.
There is a national program that WOSU took part in for years called Ready to Learn. Mm-hmm. And that's something that our listeners may not know about, but maybe the phrase Ready to Learn, they might have heard it here and there. That lost funding, too. It was created in 1992 to supply educational and programming and materials for preschool children and school-aged children, but it was mainly grants. Can you talk a little bit about, like, so you would apply for a Ready to Learn, you would get an idea, and then you'd apply for a Ready to Learn grant. Is that how it worked?
When I was hired, we had a Ready to Learn grant. So mm-hmm. we were a Ready to Learn station, and then because the funding came from the U.S. Department of Education, and you know, across the country, there were a lot of Ready to Learn stations. I believe in 2006-07, that funding stream changed, and then the Ready to Learn went away. A lot of station Ready to Learn grants went away. Mm-hmm. A lot of stations relied on community partners to be able to continue Ready to Learn work, and that's what we did here. Mm-hmm. We did apply for a Ready to Learn grant. We were awarded a few years ago, and so we were that last round, and mm-hmm. we were cut. Mm-hmm. And you know, we had built so many positive relationships with the families that we were working with the community partners, and then just to be told beginning of May, you can't do this anymore. It was just very, it was horrible. Yeah. Horrible.
Yeah, very devastating. And also, and it's just something you've been doing for years, and now you can't do it anymore.
Yep.
So, but there are other opportunities. So you mentioned like PNC Grow Up Great. That's a different funding source. So you can continue to do these math kits because it's not federal funding. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Despite whether or not we had Ready to Learn funding or not, we rely on grants to do the things that we're doing. And so, yes, we were awarded a PNC Great Grow Up Great grant. And then, you know, some other ones that we've got in the works, too, that I'm not sure if I can speak of yet or not, but
stay tuned. Yes. Mm-hmm. PNC Grow Up Great grant. Say that 3 times fast.
Yeah.
And another one I know that you are spend a lot of time with is called Be My Neighbor Day. Who is that through?
So the grant is through Fred Rogers Productions. PNC Grow Up Great is also involved, and they're a partner. So this year our Be My Neighbor Day is, and I had to write this down, November 8th, I believe. Yeah, November 8th. It's 10 to 12. And it's at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. And so we are partnering with the Vets Museum, with PNC Grow Up Great. CAS will be involved mm-hmm. as well. And so, you know, bringing it back to the PBS Kids programming. So there's a Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood episode called Neighbor Day. And Daniel Tiger learns that doing caring, kind things can create a chain of events. And so as he's doing these kind things, other people in his neighborhood does. So this is what, you know, sparks Be My Neighbor Day. So what we're doing here in Central Ohio is we will be creating hygiene kits for veterans. You can donate supplies and come to the event, or you could just simply come to the event. But we will have kits, or we'll be making kits and have all the materials to develop these hygiene kits. And it's a fun event and a big event also.
Well, just to end on, what's your favorite PBS Kids program just to teach people about?
I have to go with Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. He's our biggest program. I love working at Wombats. Also, Lila in the Loop is another fan favorite. So I don't think I have one that I don't like, honestly. I like them all.
That's great. That's a good answer. But Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood has definitely been a star of recent years.
Absolutely.
And hopefully maybe Weather Hunters can be a new star coming up.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, especially with Al Roker on board.
Absolutely.
All right, we've been talking with Jan Pollard, Early Childhood and Outreach Coordinator at WOSU Public Media with WOSU Classroom. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jan.
Thanks for having me.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.